Hi there, and welcome to the Growing Opportunities podcast series. I am Michelle Roberge.
And I am Megan Darcy.
We are the agriculture coordinators for the regional district of Bulkley Chaco.
We are small-scale farmers with a keen interest in agriculture, and we're excited to be using this format to communicate information about regional agriculture to the broader community. This podcast series will touch on different agriculture topics important to new farmers and producers wanting to diversify their farm operations.
If you have questions about these podcasts or anything agriculture in the regional district, please go to rdbn.bc.ca, click on the agriculture link, and you'll find our contact information there.
We hope that you enjoy this podcast series on growing opportunities in the RDBN.
The RDBN is providing this podcast as a public service. It is neither a legal interpretation nor a statement of government policies. Reference to any specific product or entity does not constitute an endorsement or recommendation by the RDBN. The views expressed by staff and guests are their own and do not represent the opinion of the RDBN or any of its directors. Presenters are not subject matter experts, and information presented should be verified by certified professionals prior to informing business or legal decisions.
Today I'll be speaking with two experienced and longtime vegetable producers from opposite ends of the regional district. First, I'll speak with Joe Hug of Healthy Hug Organics out of Smithers, and then Linda and Don Borno of Borno Farms here in Vanderhoof. Welcome, Joe. I really appreciate your time to join us for this podcast today about growing vegetables. From doing a scan on your website, which is really nice, by the way, I read that your goal is freshness at an affordable price by farming in a sustainable way for a healthy world with healthy people. And I read that and I thought that was just great. Can you just tell us a bit about you and, you know, your family and how you shaped your vegetable farm to follow that goal?
Okay. Yeah, I was born on this farm, and it was a beef cattle farm since the 1940s, I guess. My grandparents moved here to Smithers from Switzerland in the mid-1930s, and my father took over the farm, and it stayed a beef farm. They did plant lots of potatoes as well, and they farmed a lot of vegetables, but they didn't sell vegetables. So when I got this part of the land, I wanted to do something different. And when I was younger, I traveled a lot of the world, and I really saw that we need to be more sustainable. And I've always loved vegetable farming. I did a lot of things before. I guess this farm is about 15 years old now, Healthy Hugs Organics, which means I didn't really start this till I was about 40. And it just started very small. It was a trial. It was experimental to see how it would go. And I didn't invest too much money into it. I just had some old equipment, which I fixed up. I did a lot of research. I read a lot of books. I studied soil science. That was a very, very big thing that changed my life, soil science. And I realized that we humans are not that much different than plants in that way. It's so much as about building and maintaining our immune systems.
Now, you're certified organic, right? And you're through the Okanagan Organic Association. So, you know, I can hazard a guess, but why did you decide to go the organic route?
I do realize that in this region, most of the vegetable producers, even if they're not certified organic, are more or less organic anyway. At least I think they are. So I just thought, if I really want to be serious about it, I should certify organic. That way I'm really into it, you know, that way there's really no way out. I gotta be organic. When they come and inspect you, you know, they're pretty thorough. But you really have to hit the books and realize what is and what isn't really organic, because it's pretty hard to tell sometimes. The organic certification, it's not easy, but as long as you take the time and get to know it, then it becomes, you know, you don't really need to fear it, because it is really, looking back at it, it's fairly basic. And you just have to understand what plants need and a lot of it, you know, compost, and we do a lot of cover cropping here. And over time, your soil just builds up and gets better and better.
And so the for anyone who would be interested, like, what are the first few steps in becoming certified organic?
You have to contact a certification body like NOAA or the COABC, and just tell them you're interested in doing it, and they'll give you the steps. And it takes 3 or 4 years to become fully certified. And it's good to know what land was used for. Sometimes, you know, if the farmer before you was using lots of glyphosate or something, it might be a lot more difficult. Luckily, down here on this farm, my father, he was fairly organic minded as well.
Okay, so it's not just I want to be certified organic, you know, this summer. So it's kind of a long game. And I also noticed, like, I spent quite a bit of time on your website. You offer, as one of the ways you get vegetables to people, you have veggie boxes. So why did you choose to do first of all, can you tell us what a veggie box is? And then why did you choose to go that route?
An important thing for a farmer is not to have just one venue, not just one avenue of sales. You need a few, like Healthy House Organics. Through the years, we have the farmer's market, we have some restaurants, we have Buckley Valley Wholesale, which is over Wadey. We have the Out of Hand store in Smithers, and we do a lot of private sales and whatnot. And then the box program, it's kind of a CSA, community supported agriculture. We don't follow those rules totally, because in a real CSA, if the farmer has a loss, then everybody in the CSA takes a little bit of the loss. But if we have a loss, we just absorb the loss, but we really haven't had any real money, what I could call really big crop failures. So, and that's mainly because of the soil science, I would say. I was just quite confident in being able to tell people that, you prepay these boxes, and if we don't deliver you a box, we bring your money back. I'm not sure if that was such a wise business decision, but it sounded very, very authentic. And so far it's worked for us.
So how many veggie boxes do you sell?
We start the box program first week of July, and it goes to the middle of October. And it's anywhere from 60 to 100 boxes a week that we'll be doing. The first two boxes in July are sometimes difficult if the year is slow. You know, we might not have carrots yet, might not have some things. So we really want to put a lot of amazing variety into the boxes. And then the last box of the year is difficult too, because, you know, we won't have any lettuce anymore. You know, a lot of the midsummer crops are done, but then we have our storage onions and of course potatoes, carrots, and big avalanche of vegetables in October.
And you said you sell to restaurants and grocers. So is there anything special you need to do to be able to sell to restaurants or grocers?
Yeah. With both of LA Health Wholesale, they wanted us to have insurance, and they wanted us to have a food safety description of what we do. And of course, being organic was kind of the ace there too. And then with the Out of Hand store, I think we had to present something to the health inspector, I think it was, and sign something, and it was all good.
I also saw on your website that you have a Volunteer for Veggies program, and I thought that was kind of cool. So can you explain what that is, and then just give us an idea of, you know, how much uptake you have for that?
Well, we had people who wanted to come down and just work for just volunteer, right? And that's fine, but I always thought there should be some kind of an exchange. So I said, here, at least we'll get you a veggie box if you work, come work a day, you know, or whatever. And a lot of people were just happy to get on a farm and work in clean soil, and they feel really grounded. I mean, there's some jobs that, you know, people can just do, like weeding, or some things that are fairly basic. But I think a lot of people don't realize just how many skills are needed to do some of these jobs on the farm.
Absolutely. And you said you have 4 or 5 staff. Do your staff come back, or do you have new people every year? And is there ever a problem finding people to work on your farm seasonally?
People who have the knowledge and just the type of what it takes to work in a garden. You know, I don't know. It's strange because you can have two people weeding a plot, and it looks like they're doing the same job, but one of them's getting twice as much done as the other one. Same with harvesting. They're harvesting something, and just by looking quickly, it looks like they're doing the same thing. But in half an hour, one person has like three crates full, the other person has one crate full. And those are small nuances in the way people work. And one's not working much harder than the other one, it's just working smarter. And we live in a society where people are really good with their thumbs now, but maybe not so keen to work with their arms and eyes. And it's really hand-eye coordination, a lot of it.
Well, that's good. Do you use like woofers or that kind of, connect with those kind of organizations to get employees?
In the past, we used woofers, and it was quite successful. For the most part, once woofers make it all the way up to spenders, they're usually pretty serious. But most woofers only stay for about maybe 2 weeks to 2 months.
Okay.
And then, you know, it takes 2-3 weeks to kind of train someone just to know the basics about how it goes around here. Yeah, and the nice thing about having employees is they come down, you pay them well, you know, they bring a lunch. It's more formal, and they're in it for the long haul. And most of the employees do come back year after year.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. So this year I'm getting, I think, 4 out of the 5 employees coming back, I think it is.
Wow.
Yeah.
And that definitely helps you, right? Less training and time spent doing
it's that. Big. Yeah, that's very important. Yeah, very important. I mean, I've had people come down to the farm to work here, and for some reason, I don't know why, but a lot of people have this idea that, oh, I can't do anything else, so I'll just go work on a farm. You know, say, oh, okay. Well, for some things, that is probably true, but for a lot of things, you gotta really have your wits about you to really do a good job on the farm. And it's underestimated what it really takes. You got to be in fairly good physical condition for one thing. Clear. You got to not be afraid to get dirty. You got to be tough. You got to love what you're doing. Yeah, it's there's a lot of things, a lot of check marks to really do well working on a farm. But it's so rewarding. It's I've had a lot of jobs in my life. This is the best job I've ever had by far.
So you have, if you do veggie boxes and restaurants and direct sales and farmers market, and you have 4 to 5 employees, how big is your garden?
it's not very big, really. So they ask me how much land are you farming now, you know, in cultivation, and I'm not really sure, but say if it's 3 or 4 acres every year, I'll have like 8 acres that's all plowed, and 1 year I'll be using half of that for vegetable growing, and the other half is in cover crop of usually barley and field peas or something like that, and then I disc that into the soil, and that feeds the soil for the next year. And the next year it's gonna be cover crop. It just goes back and forth, so I cover crop every second year. So I think that's really a lot of the success of this farm. If I have a good cover crop and I've got a 10-foot disc, I just disc it in the soil. And it rots in there, and it creates a natural environment for plants to thrive.
Okay, we're gonna do like a bit of a quick fire, the basic. So here's just some quick questions, the basics that you would recommend. So you're out Smithers Way, but so what are the most, you know, sort of hearty and simple vegetables to get started with?
Yeah, it's quite surprising what we can actually grow here. But for the basics, I would say most root vegetables like carrots and beets and radishes and potatoes. And then you got brassicas, cabbage grows really well here. Broccoli, kohlrabi, cauliflower, lettuce, of course, grows well here. So I would definitely start with all of those.
So how much space is a sort of a good amount to start with for your growing for your family?
Maybe 1,000 square feet would be pretty good. And that's lots. And it's amazing, you know, 1,000 square feet, if you do it really intensively and you do a high volume compost. It's amazing what you can grow on that. An incredible amount of food, really. And you got to have full sun and, you know, a good pH level. There's a lot of variables. I was kind of lucky down here, river bottom. I mean, when I started, it wasn't the greatest soil, but it was a pretty good start. It had a pretty good start, and I was able to build on that.
So what would you say are the essential starter tools for your garden?
It's good to have a tiller, but you might want to share that with two or three other families, because that's an expensive piece of equipment that you wouldn't really use very often anyway. But in a small scale garden, you could just use a broad fork instead of a tiller. It's a lot more work, but it's probably better for the soil. And then, of course, I mean, a broad fork isn't cheap either, really. I think they're about $300, $400 now for just a broad fork. And a tiller is going to be anywhere from $800 to $1,200, you know, up to the $1,800 if you buy a really skookum one. And, you know, a good rake, a couple of hoes, a stirrup hoe for weeding. But for a small plot, I mean, you could probably, especially if you got kids, you can just weed everything by hand. That's what we used to do when I was a kid.
Oh, totally. And so prep the soil, got your tools in the right location, right size. Okay, seeds. What do you do about seeds?
Well, I mean, you can just go to your local store and buy seeds, and sometimes that's fine. But I found, you know, they'll sell last year's seeds, you know, just whatever. And the seeds they sell, they'll stay in a warm place for a long, long time, maybe. That's why I buy from a reputable seed dealer, like, you know, Johnny Seeds out of Maine, or William Dam somewhere in East Canada, or Vessies or Stokes. There's a few really good seed companies. You just order by phone or online. But on a small scale, I mean, if you just went to your local store where they sell seeds, it's probably okay. I mean, if you're doing it commercially, probably okay, good enough. You gotta be pretty sure you got good seeds.
Do you save any of your seeds?
Not much. And it's something a lot of people ask me, and I really think it's something I should start doing more. I save potatoes from the year before. I do some squash. I do that, some tomato seeds. And I did some with some brassicas a bit, but not near as much as I probably should. It's a whole different vocation with different skills. You can be a great gardener and not know anything about saving seeds.
Great. Well, my last question for you, Joe, you've been so gracious with your time and your knowledge. Do you have any final words of wisdom, 2 to 3 of your top tips for new or experienced vegetable growers in the North if they're starting out or venturing into the market garden?
I think read up on soil science and realize really it's about building the immune system of your plants, because that's going to be the most important thing. And the right nutrients for your plants, it's not much different than us, right? We need the right nutrients to have our immune systems be strong. Try to get the right varieties. I mean, a lot of people just go to the store and they buy, oh, radish is so good, or, you know, so spinach. But it's important, like for up here, for example, you need to get spinach, get some spinach variety that doesn't bolt very easily, because we got those long, long days in June. And if you get the wrong variety of spinach, it's just going to bolt on you and go to seed, and it's not going to make many leaves. See, if you have some onions and it says there, you know, 140 day onions or whatever, well, that's not going to cut it up here. You got to get onions that say 90 to 110 days at the most, I would say. And also you got to get onions that are like, there's short day onions and long day onions. Up here, you got to buy what's called long day onions, because then they'll bulb when the days start to get long. If you get that wrong, you're not going to have any onions. And then also I see people overwatering or underwatering, or probably more underwatering their crops than overwatering. Especially here, we have a lot of sandy loamy soil where, my soil is quite sandy loam, and I've got to water quite a bit. Yeah, you got to keep water. I mean, I've got a good organic matter in my soil now, so it's not like it's not quite as bad as it used to be. But then if you have soil that holds water too much, then plants don't get enough, then the roots don't get enough oxygen.
Well, thanks, Joe. And thank you for your time and your knowledge. It is, I know there's always lots of questions about growing. Lots of people feel like they're you know, don't have a green thumb, but I think with, you know, the research and the trial and error and understanding, you know, the soil and your the aspect and your heat units and all that, you know, I believe in encouraging people, more people to grow their own food because that's all about that regional sustainability and food security. Thank you, Linda, for joining me today to talk about vegetables and market gardens. So I know a little bit about how you do things. So how long have you two been selling vegetables as your main income?
Well, thanks, Michelle. We started in 1992. I read an article in Harrowsmith magazine about community-supported agriculture. And so I wanted to be a stay-at-home mom and, you know, have a little income. So we started out between, we worked with a partner, and we started out with 7 families the first year, and then we grew to 15, and then the following year, and then to 30, and then to 70, and then I think we went up to 120 in all. And we were certified organic then. But since then, we dropped the certification just because I agree with certified organic and the certified organic principles. But it was just more paperwork. And, you know, we figured if people know us, they kind of know how we grow.
So going back, you started with 7 boxes. And so I'm assuming, you know, you had some size of plot of ground for that. And so going up to 120 or whatever, that must have taken, I'm assuming, more space.
Well, we started out with just basically a home garden with the 7 boxes because there was 2 of us doing it, right? And then we would take turns going, I'd go out to her farm and sort the veggies there. And then we just, we tilled up an acre more and just started expanding bit by bit. And that was like really heavy clay soil. And yeah, so.
Right. So there was a lot of, you know, soil augmentation and all that work to go into that.
Yes. But knowing now what I know of regenerative agriculture, we would have done it way different.
Okay.
Yeah.
So how so?
Well, what we did was till. We brought in lots of manure and tilled that in. And you were always competing with weed pressure. And by tilling, you're always compacting the soil. So the clay soil wasn't improving much just because you're tilling every year and breaking up the mycelium and all that. And yeah, you just compact.
Right. And so do you think it took you longer to get your beds to a point where you could really grow healthy plants?
Yes. If I were to start out today, I would till initially to get rid of the, you know, we did a field. So we would till initially, set up your beds permanently in the ground, 30-inch bed, because most tools are made for 30-inch beds. Most hand tools are made for 30-inch beds, and 16-inch pathways. And now we're going to zero till as much as possible. And we mulch the pathways, like we do like a 16-inch pathway with wood chips or straw. But poplar wood chips are great. 2.5-inch and smaller, is really, really good. It's called, Ramiel wood chips. And they, at 2.5 inch and smaller, they have a lot of nitrogen in them. So, and then we broad fork. If I were starting today to set up my beds, I'd put a lot of compost on, you know, to start out, and then use a broad fork to loosen the soil and let the microorganisms do their part, you know, the earthworms and the bacteria and the fungi. And they say you only have to really broad fork a garden area for 3 years, and you never really have to touch it after that.
Cool.
I mean, we just started really doing the broad forking last year, and wow, what a difference.
Oh, really?
You're not bringing weed seeds up anymore. If you use compost on top, and when your pathways are chipped, you got no weeds there, and it's so clean.
Yeah.
You hardly have to even wash your veggies because you don't get the splatter, right?
Yeah. And so now that you say that, bring up regenerative agriculture, I remember you took a whole regenerative agriculture course last year, right?
Yes, I was reading about it for a while. And yeah, after taking that really inspired me.
Oh, great. And that's pretty immediate results, right?
It is. It really is. Yeah. And leaving the roots in the ground over the winter as much as possible. You know, take the above ground stuff off, but leave the roots in the ground, because I mean, you're not harboring insects by taking out the old brassicas and whatnot, but you're leaving the roots in the ground for the soil life. And I mean, if it's in your way next spring, you can pull them out, but there's hardly anything left of the roots then.
Yeah, I suppose so, hey? And I guess that helps with breaking up the soil, keeping that in there too.
Yeah. And this year we tried tillage radish, putting that in after our summer crops were done, so that they die over the winter, but they stay in the soil and they give the microorganisms lots to eat off of over the winter. And in doing so, when you plant your spring crops, all of that nitrogen that's stored in the root of the tillage radish is released to the plants in the spring.
So it's a winter cover crop, essentially.
Yep. Yeah, we use that, and we use annual rye.
Okay.
We plant that down, and that you can just rake off in the spring if you have to seed it, or just pull it aside and use it as a mulch you put your plants in.
Wow, this is great, great advice. And
we're learning. We're still learning.
Yeah, I guess so.
I think it's a forever, you know, you learn.
Yeah. Do you have any raised beds in your greenhouses, or is it?
Yes, they're all raised as well.
Oh, they are.
Same type of thing.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
Raised beds in the ground. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
They're not contained.
Oh,
raised beds. They're raised beds in the ground, and then there's wood chipped in the pathways.
Okay, so just like
the wood chips also, Michelle, help keep moisture in.
Okay.
And in the wood chips too, you've got the fungi and the mycorrhizal exchanging nutrients and water with the plants that are growing.
Yeah.
You know, in turn, the plant feeds the fungi.
Yeah. So do you find that you've had to water a little bit less because of this system?
I think in time, yes, absolutely will. Because when the mycorrhizal also creates glomalin, which creates aggregate in your soil, the binding of the soil.
Okay.
That's one thing we've always had problems with in our soil is the more you till, the more powdery it becomes. Like without tilling, you get all those benefits.
Well, that's great. So is it just you and Don doing all this?
We have hired help that comes 2 to 3 days a week. Yeah, one lady.
Okay. And is that consistent? Like, do she come every year? Do you have to find somebody new?
She has so far. I haven't talked to her this spring yet.
Right.
Yeah. And then we have grandkids that come and help out once in a while and for little exchange money.
Yeah. They can go to the farmer's market and spend it, right?
Yep.
Do you do, you know, bulk root vegetable sales in the fall or anything?
Just a little bit. Yeah. Not much.
No. So it's primarily the CSA and the farmer's market then.
Yep. Yeah. And we get rid of just about everything. So,
and
so we did 60 bins last year.
Yeah. And that goes from early June or to October or
mid-May to mid-October.
Okay.
Yeah, the bins get all the early stuff in the greenhouses.
Right. So what are the most hardy and simple vegetables to start to be successful?
Cabbage, spinach, lettuce, kale. Gosh, just about everything if your soil's good. And you know, my advice there would be to start small. Don't dive in over your head, because I think you're going to burn yourself out.
So I guess that leads to the second question. How much space is a good amount for someone to start, say if they want to, you know, feed a small family?
Half an acre to an acre.
And then what are the essential tools for the garden?
A broad fork, a wheel hoe to do the pathways and until you've got your pathways mulched. I use a stirrup hoe or a rocker hoe. And then to get in small spaces, I use a collinear hoe. It's just like a little razor blade on the end of a handle, and it just cuts them off at the soil surface. The hoe that I use for making, it's a hoe rake. It's a 30 inch wide rake, and then you put on prongs, like plastic prongs, to mark out your rows, and so you can get all three of your rows or four or five rows set in a bed in one pass. And then cedars, we use the Earthway cedar. It's a cheaper cedar, and it's great for using for radish and spinach, I find. And then the Jang cedar we just purchased last year is really good for carrots and hookerai turnip.
And then where is the best place to get seeds when everything's prepped and ready to go?
We buy from William Dam usually. Okay. We find them the cheapest and with the biggest variety, and we also use West Coast seeds.
Your words of wisdom, you've given a lot already, and I so appreciate it. But what would be, you know, say your top two, even three tips or words of wisdom for those looking to start up market gardening and or expand their gardens?
Well, soil's number one.
Right.
Yeah. The soil is number one. If you get bad under control, you know, you've got everything beat. You've got, you know, we haven't gotten to the place yet where a lot of advanced growers that have really good, awesome soil say that they don't even have bug issues. But we use the Remay fabric to cover for root maggots and carrot rust fly. Yeah, but soil is number one.
Good. And yeah, and covering for pests, right?
And covering for pests, especially when you first start out, because you are going to have pests?
Flea beetle. That's my nemesis.
Flea beetles, yeah. And they're mainly in the early spring, right? They like the cold soil. So do the root maggot fly. It likes the cold soil. So around your onions and brassicas, nothing more disappointing as to lose so many plants to root maggots. And you don't realize it until
I guess so, hey?
It's almost too late.
I can't grow an onion for the life of me. They just don't grow. And I have lots of clay too. So, and we're just fighting our soil. So I think that's why it's so important for us to change over to what you're doing now, because it is just, it's hard to get a beautiful thing come out of the ground.
Yeah. And with the beds, Michelle, I'd like to also say, if you stay to a consistent size on the length of your beds, and you cut all your fabric to the same size, you're not, you know, hauling out blankets and it's too short or it's too long.
That's a really good tip.
They're all the same size.
That's an excellent tip. And I guess, how do you water, actually? I didn't ask about that.
Just an overhead sprinkler.
I do have an overhead sprinkler. Okay.
Yep.
Okay.
And when it's really hot, we'll just water by hand with the hose, get the water where it's necessary. And
okay.
Yeah.
You don't use drip lines?
No.
No.
I find them a nuisance. But I mean, each to their own, you know, some people love them. So. Yeah.
Well, this was fabulous. I so appreciate your time. And I appreciate your time back there, Dawn. I know you're there.
He's giving you the
boom. Awesome.
Thanks again to my guests, Joe Hug and Linda and Dawn Borno, for speaking with me today. This episode was hosted by me, Michelle Roberge, and edited by Pamela Hassam. Our liability waiver was read by Jason Llewellyn, and info about the regional district by me and Megan Darcy. Artwork is by me, Michelle Roberge, and music for Growing Opportunities is found on the Free Music Archive.
Thanks for listening, and we hope you enjoyed this episode of the Growing Opportunities podcast series. This and other Growing Opportunities podcasts can be accessed through all major podcast apps and on the RDBN and CICK websites. The link to the RDBN website is rdbn.bc.ca. Keep growing!